This is the World War II Radio Podcast.
A date which will live in infamy.
This is London.
We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Go ahead, Berlin. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Welcome to the World War II Radio Podcast. Today we have an episode of The Story Behind the Headlines. This episode focuses on Guadalcanal and aired on October 18, 1942. It was produced by NBC in cooperation with the American Historical Association and hosted by Cesar Searchinger, one of the pioneers of transatlantic broadcasting. The World War II Radio Podcast is a Brick Pickle Media production. If you like the show, please leave feedback on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And be sure to visit our website at brickpicklemedia.com/podcasts, where you can find links to past episodes as well as the books featured in our podcasts. So thanks for listening. Enjoy today's episode of the World War II Radio Podcast.
The Story Behind the Headlines. In cooperation with the American Historical Association, we again present Cesar Searchinger, noted foreign correspondent and writer, in an informal analysis of the news. Mr. Searchinger retraces the events of the past to help you in arriving at a fuller understanding of what is happening today. Mr. Searchinger's subject tonight is what's happening on Guadalcanal. Mr. Searchinger.
Good evening. It looks as though Guadalcanal were to become a historic name. Ever since the U.S. Marines landed on this jungle-clad island in the Southern Solomons Group early last August, it has been singled out for special attention by our enemies. It now promises to become the center of a major operation which may determine the course of the Pacific War. After weeks of preliminary attempts and setbacks on land, on sea, and in the air, the Japanese sent a fleet to the north of Guadalcanal, which heavily bombarded our airfield and marine installations during the night from Tuesday to Wednesday this week. On Thursday, they were landing fairly large contingents of troops under the cover of their guns to the west of the territory held by our men. It now looks as though this is part of a full-scale offensive with the purpose of driving us out. During a previous attempt to land troops last Sunday night and Monday, the Japanese are said to have lost a heavy cruiser, four destroyers, and a transport. Three further cruisers and several other vessels hit tonight by U.S. Army bombers may also be lost. This brings their losses in this area up to well over 40 ships in the last 2 months, an investment which the Japs have evidently not made just for the sake of saving face. The landing of the U.S. Marines on the Solomon Islands on August 7 to 8 was the first offensive action of the United Nations in the Pacific and the first reconquest of enemy-held territory. The importance of the southern outpost of Japanese power is only beginning now to be generally understood. By the capture of Tulagi, parts of Guadalcanal and other islands, we have established an outpost well in advance of our defense line, running all the way from Alaska to Australia. The cost of this outpost to us in terms of naval losses was high, as the Navy disclosed early only this week, over 2 months after the event. For in the operations covering our landings, we lost no less than four U.S. cruisers, besides the cruiser Canberra, pride of the Australian Navy, the loss of which was announced at the time. These ships were standing by, screening the landing operations of the U.S. Marines on Guadalcanal, Tulagi, and five other tiny islands. They were attacked by a swift-moving column of Japanese ships, sweeping round Savo Island, 8 miles offshore, firing as they went. But it was a hit-and-run affair. The Jap ships disappeared as quickly as they came and never really got within range of our transports and landing barges. The landing operations were completed within 48 hours, and by the fourth day, August 10th, the Marines had overcome all opposition on Tulagi and the small neighboring islands. On Guadalcanal, a much larger island, about the size of Long Island, lying some 20-odd miles further south, the problem was more complicated. The Marines took possession of a small grassy plain on the north coast, where the Japs had been building an airfield. It would be about the only possible airfield in the Southern Solomons, which are steeply mountainous. Together with Tulagi Harbor, across only 22 miles of water, it would make a strong naval and air base, dominating the whole region. It would have been the terminal stronghold of the Japanese conquest at its farthest south. What we did was to go in and take that stronghold before the airfield was finished. The airfield then became the key to our position in the Solomons. But our men occupied no more than a strip of coastal territory about 5 miles long and running back to the wooded hills. Somewhere in those hills, in the jungle-clad plains to the east, were the remnants of the Japanese occupying force, living off coconuts. And they weren't left alone for long. While Japanese surface vessels, submarines, and aircraft continued to raid our positions, small parties managed to land and melt into the jungle to join their comrades at concealed bases. On August 20th, 700 Japs suddenly rushed up to the coast in speedboats. All but 30 were killed, the rest captured. All through September, the attacks continued. During the day, our bombers would range far and wide looking for Japanese ships and blasting Jap installations in the whole Solomons area. But during the night, fast Japanese destroyers would close in, strike, land reinforcements, and sneak away. The Marines were kept busy hunting down these reinforcements, as well as stalking the patrols sent out from the Japanese bases at night. In the night of September 12th to 13th, the reinforced Japs, though devoid of heavy equipment, attacked, while large fleets of Jap bombers and fighters bombed our positions. The Japs were defeated and driven back into the jungle. But their patrols kept coming back, and pretty soon our flyers spotted Japanese transports duly escorted in the surrounding seas. The engagement last Sunday night, when the Japs lost 6 ships, was the result. Despite these losses, other Jap ships came back, indicating that a large fleet concentration was supporting the action from somewhere nearby. This time, they were able to land strong reinforcements, as well as guns, within shelling distance to the west of our camp, while our Navy was evidently not there to intercept. However, no full-scale fighting has yet taken place up to the Navy's communique issued last night. Our Marines, we are told, have been reinforced from Army bases in New Caledonia, the New Hebrides, and the Fiji Islands, presumably by air. Their position is not easy. I mean the position of the Marines, for they are liable to attack from at least 2 sides, as well as from the sea, unless we have naval forces in the neighborhood strong enough to beat off the Japanese ships. In the end, the mastery of the Solomon's Islands will be decided by the relative strength of opposing naval and air forces, which may even now be gathering for a clash. Seen in the perspective of the whole Pacific War, this Battle of the Solomons, like the struggle in the mountains of New Guinea and the air attacks on the fog-bound Aleutians, is a phase of what Hanson Baldwin calls the Battle of the Outposts. After the turbulent months of the great Japanese offensive and the long drawn-out effort of building up our supply lines to New Zealand and Australia, the two opposing sides have settled down behind something like 2 enormous lines of defense. The Japanese line reaches from Kamchatka in the icy north to New Guinea, way below the equator in the south. The American line runs from Nome, Alaska, through Dutch Harbor, Hawaii, Samoa, and New Caledonia to the Australian coast. Each side has pushed forward its steely tentacles to certain advanced points, the Japanese to Kiska, to Wake, the Marshall, Gilbert, and Solomon Islands, the Americans to the Andreyev Islands in the Aleutians, to Midway, and to the southeastern Solomons, Tulagi and Guadalcanal. These are the points of contact whenever there is fighting, which is usually swift and fierce. The forces engaged are relatively not large, but they represent the spearheads of 2 opposing fronts stretching over thousands of miles through the vast Pacific space. So great are the distances, so far are the points of contact from any home base, that the vast majority of ships and planes and men are employed in maintaining and protecting the lines of supply. Besides, the island battlefields are so small, so difficult in terrain, and so scattered, that only few soldiers are likely to get into action at any one time. but they nevertheless represent the enormous naval and military powers which make it possible to project the spearheads so far from home. To all intents and purposes, then, the tiny Solomon Plains and the New Guinea mountain trails today are the main focal points of the Great Pacific Front. The events of this week indicate that the Japanese are making this the main theater of war. In New Guinea, it is true, they have been forced to retreat across the Owen Stanley Range, probably because Allied air power has destroyed their communications and their base. But this is not the first time the Japanese have been forced to give up their advance towards Port Moresby, only to reappear on another trail. The Japanese positions on New Guinea support the right flank of their action in the Solomons. They cannot afford to give up either. For if they lost New Guinea and the Solomons, they would open the way to a two-pronged offensive by the United Nations from the east and eventually from the west. On the other hand, the capture of Port Moresby and the recapture of the southern Solomons are indispensable to the Japanese if they wish to consolidate their vast conquests to the north and east. For after all, the Japanese now have an enormous new empire to defend. This conquered area, if we include Thailand, stretches from Indochina to the borders of India and from the Philippines to New Guinea. It is a continental and island area of over 2 million square miles, more than half the size of the United States, with a population roughly equal to that of the United States. This does not include any part of China. By the conquest of the Chinese maritime regions, Japan has linked that empire to her earlier conquests of Manchuria and Korea, and to the Japanese islands. This is, after all, the so-called co-prosperity sphere for which Japan claims to have gone to war. She holds it together very largely by means of her naval supremacy in the Western Pacific, a supremacy which is bound to be challenged sooner or later by ourselves and our allies. However, this challenge is not likely to materialize for some time. Aside from this, the Japanese Empire is vulnerable from three directions: from Vladivostok and Siberian bases in the north, from the Indo-Burmese frontier in the west, and from Australia in the south. Let's see which is the most imminent of these threats. The first, from Siberia, will not become an actuality unless war breaks out between Russia and Japan. Some time ago, when Japan was moving troops from southwestern China to the north, it looked as though she might have been getting ready for the long-discussed stab in the back. But the heroic stand of the Red Army at Stalingrad and on the Volga has probably not increased the Japanese zest for the job. The second threat from India is certainly on the cards, for sooner or later the Japs will have to be expelled from Burma if China is to be freed from her semi-isolation. Allied land and air power in India are steadily growing, but the mountains between India and Burma present appalling difficulties to the British as well as to the Japs. So the threat from that direction will probably not be serious until Anglo-American naval strength are overwhelming in the Bay of Bengal. By the process of elimination, we come to the fourth threat against the Japanese, from the Southwest Pacific. Here the tension has been rising ever since the aforesaid invasion of the Solomon Islands by the United States. It is the most immediate threat the Japanese have to face from any direction at the present time. That is what gives the action on Guadalcanal its importance in the global war. The events in the Solomons, in New Guinea, the situation on the Indian border and in the Siberian Far East, and the brutal struggle in the streets of Stalingrad are all part of the same pattern. Whatever may be the final outcome of that historic battle of Stalingrad, this much can already be said. Russia is not beaten to earth this year any more than she was beaten to earth last year when Hitler and his propaganda chief solemnly announced that she was. Last year, when he failed to take Moscow, Hitler was able to minimize his failure by pulling a large rabbit out of his hat, the entry of Japan into the war. This time, the magician's hat is empty, and the Japanese rabbit is running around on his own. Instead of the one totalitarian war of the Axis, we still have two separate and distinct wars. What the Japanese are concerned with, apparently, is the problem of holding what they have in the Pacific while Hitler prepares to hold what he has in the West. Both Hitler and his partner appear to be entering a war of position, whether they like it or not. That does not mean that they are on the defensive and that the offensive has passed to us. But Japan at least has lost one of the large strategic advantages she had 10 months ago. She is forced to fight, not in order to advance, but in order to be able to stay where she is. She is using her forces not to conquer, but to hold. Even if she succeeds on Guadalcanal, she has lost time, men, ships, and resources to keep what she already had 6 months ago. And she can less afford to lose ships and resources than we. To grasp the offensive against incalculable odds is the job of the United Nations in 1943. Our action in the Solomons is a modest indication of what is to come. Good night.
You've been listening to Caesar Searchinger, whom we've presented in cooperation with the American Historical Association. This program came to you from New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.